The myths agree that an extraordinary capacity is required to face and survive such experiences. The infancies abound in anecdotes of precious strength, cleverness, and wisdom. Heracles strangled a serpent sent against his cradle by the goddess Hera. Maui of Polynesia snared and slowed the sun to give his mother time to cook her meals. Abraham, as we have seen, arrived at the knowledge of the one God. Jesus confounded the wise men. The baby Buddha had been left one day beneath the shade of a tree. His nurses suddenly noted that the shadow had not moved all afternoon and that the child was sitting fixed in a yogic trance. The feats of the beloved Hindu savior, Krishna, during his infant exile among the cowherds of Gokula and Vrindavan, constitute a lively cycle. A certain goblin named Putana came in the shape of a beautiful woman, but with poison in her breasts. She entered the house of Yasoda, the foster mother of the child, and made herself very friendly, presently taking the baby in her lap to give it suck. But Krishna drew so hard that he sucked away her life, and she fell dead, reassuming her huge and hideous form. When the foul corpse was cremated, however, it emitted a sweet fragrance, for the divine infant had given the demoness salvation when he had drunk her milk. Krishna was a mischievous little boy. He liked to spirit away the pots of curds when the milkmaids were asleep. He was forever climbing to eat and spill things placed out of his reach on the high shelves. The girls would call him Butter Thief and complain to Yasoda, but he could always invent a story. One afternoon when he was playing in the yard, his foster parent was warned that he was eating clay. She arrived with a switch, but he had wiped his lips and denied all knowledge of the matter. She opened the dirty mouth to see, but when she peered inside, beheld the whole universe, the three worlds. She thought, "How silly I am to imagine that my son could be the lord of the three worlds." Then all was veiled from her again, and the moment passed immediately from her mind. She fondled the little boy and took him home. The herding folk were accustomed to pay worship to the god Indra, the Hindu counterpart of Zeus, king of heaven and lord of rain. One day, when they had made their offering, the lad Krishna said to them, "Indra is no supreme deity. Though he be king in heaven, he is afraid of the Titans. Furthermore, the rain and prosperity for which you are praying depend on the sun, which draws up the waters and makes them fall again. What can Indra do? Whatever comes to pass is determined by the laws of nature and the spirit." Then he turned their attention to the nearby woods, streams, and hills, and especially to Mount Govardhan, as more worthy of their honor than the remote master of the air. And so they offered flowers and fruits and sweetmeats to the mountain. Krishna himself assumed a second form. He took the form of a mountain god and received the offerings of the people, meanwhile remaining in his earlier shape among them, paying worship to the mountain king. The god received the offerings and ate them up. Indra was enraged and sent for the king of the clouds, whom he commanded to pour rain over the people until all should be swept away. A flight of storm clouds drew over the district and began to discharge a deluge. It seemed the end of the world was at hand. But the lad Krishna filled Mount Govardhan with the heat of his inexhaustible energy, lifted it with his little finger, and bid the people take shelter beneath. The rain struck the mountain, hissed, and evaporated. The torrent fell 7 days, but not a drop touched the community of herdsmen. Then the god realized that the opponent must be an incarnation of the primal being. When Krishna went out next day to graze the cows, playing music on his flute, the king of heaven came down on his great white elephant, Aravata, fell on his face at the feet of the smiling lad, and made submission.
The sense of Krishna's advice to do worship to the mountain rather than the king of the gods, which to the Western reader may seem strange, is that the way of devotion, bhakti marga, must begin with things known and loved by the devotee, not remote, unimaginable conceptions. Since the Godhead is immanent in all, he will make himself known through any object profoundly regarded. Furthermore, it is the Godhead within the devotee that makes it possible for him to discover Godhead in the world without. This mystery is illustrated in Krishna's double presence during the act of worship.
The conclusion of the childhood cycle is the return or recognition of the hero, when, after the long period of obscurity, his true character is revealed. This event may precipitate a considerable crisis, for it amounts to an emergence of powers hitherto excluded from human life. Earlier patterns break to fragments or dissolve. Disaster greets the eye. Yet after a moment of apparent havoc, the creative value of the new factor comes to view, and the world takes shape again in unsuspected glory. This theme of crucifixion-resurrection can be illustrated either on the body of the hero himself or in his effects upon his world. The first alternative we find in the Pueblo story of the water jar.
The men were going out to hunt rabbits, and Water Jar Boy wanted to go. "Grandfather, could you take me down to the foot of the mesa? I want to hunt rabbits." "Poor grandson, you can't hunt rabbits. You have no legs or arms," said the grandfather. But Water Jar Boy was very anxious to go. "Take me anyway. You are too old and you can't do anything." His mother was crying because her boy had no legs or arms or eyes. But they used to feed him in his mouth, in the mouth of the jar. So next morning, his grandfather took him down to the south on the flat. Then he rolled along, and pretty soon he saw a rabbit track, and he followed the track. Pretty soon the rabbit ran out, and he began to chase it. Just before he got to the marsh, there was a rock, and he hit himself against it and broke. And a boy jumped up. He was very glad his skin had been broken and that he was a boy, a big boy. He was wearing lots of beads around his neck and turquoise earrings and a dance kilt and moccasins and a buckskin shirt.
Catching a number of rabbits, he returned and presented them to his grandfather, who brought him triumphantly home. The cosmic energies burning within the vivid Irish warrior Cuchulainn, chief hero of the medieval Ulster cycle, the so-called cycle of the Knights of the Red Branch, would suddenly burst like an eruption, both overwhelming himself and smashing everything around.
The legendary cycles of medieval Ireland include 1. The mythological cycle, which describes the migrations to the island of prehistoric peoples, their battles, and in particular, the deeds of the race of gods known as the Tuatha De Danann, children of the great mother Dana. 2. The annals of the Milesians, or semi-historical chronicles of the last arriving race, the sons of Milesius, founders of the Celtic dynasties that survived until the arrival of the Anglo-Normans under Henry II in the 12th century. 3. The Ulster cycle of the Knights of the Red Branch, which treats primarily of the deeds of Cuchulainn at the court of his uncle, Connachar. This cycle greatly influenced the development of the Arthurian tradition in Wales, Brittany, and England, the court of Connachar serving as model for that of King Arthur, and the deeds of Cuchulainn for those of Arthur's nephew, Sir Gawain. Gawain was the original hero of many of the adventures later assigned to Lancelot, Percival, and Galahad. 4. The cycle of the Fianna. The Fianna were a company of heroic fighters under the captaincy of Finn McCool. The greatest tale of this cycle being that of the love triangle of Finn, Grianni, his bride, and Dermot, his nephew. Many episodes of which come down to us in the celebrated tale of Tristan and Isolde. 5. Legends of the Irish Saints. The little people of the popular fairy lore of Christian Ireland are reductions of the earlier pagan divinities, the Tuatha De Danann.
When Cathulainn was 4 years old, so the story goes, he set out to test the boy corps of his uncle, King Conahor, at their own sports. Carrying his hurley of brass, ball of silver, throwing javelin and toy spear, he proceeded to the court city of Emania, where, without so much as a word of permission, he dived right in among the boys, thrice 50 in number, who were hurling on the green and practicing martial exercises with Conahur's son, Pholomane, at their head. The whole field let fly at him. With his fists, forearms, palms, and little shield, he parried the hurleys, balls, and spears that came simultaneously from all directions. Then, for the first time in his life, he was seized with his battle frenzy, a bizarre, characteristic transformation later to be known as his paroxysm or distortion, and before anyone could grasp what was coming to pass, he had laid low 50 of the best. 5 more of the boy corps went scuttling past the king, where he sat playing chess with Fergus the Eloquent. Conahor arose and took a hand in the confusion, but Cathulainn would not lighten his hand until all the youngsters had been placed under his protection and guarantee. Cathulainn's first day under arms was the occasion of his full self-manifestation. There was nothing serenely controlled about this performance, nothing of the playful irony that we feel in the deeds of the Hindu Krishna. Rather, the abundance of Cathulainn's power was becoming known for the first time to himself as well as to everybody else. It broke out of the depths of his being, and then had to be dealt with, impromptu and fast. The happening was again at the court of King Conahor, the day Cathbad the Druid declared in prophecy of any stripling who that day should assume arms and armature that the name of such an one would transcend those of all Ireland's youths besides. His life, however, would be fleeting short. Cathulainn forthwith demanded fighting equipment. 17 sets of weapons given him he shattered with his strength, until Conahor invested him with his own outfit. Then he reduced the chariots to fragments. Only that of the king was strong enough to support his trial. Cathulainn commanded Conahor's charioteer to drive him past the distant lookout ford, and they came presently to a remote fortress, the Dun of the Sons of Nectan, where he cut off the heads of the defenders. He fastened the heads to the sides of the car. On the road back, he jumped to the ground and, by sheer running and mere speed, captured 2 stags of the grandest bulk. With 2 stones, he knocked out of the air 2 dozen flying swans. And with thongs and other gear, he tethered all, both the beasts and the birds, to the chariot. Lavarcan, the prophetess, beheld the pageant with alarm as it approached the city and castle of Emania. "The chariot is graced with bleeding heads of his enemies," she declared. "Beautiful white birds he has, which in the chariot bear him company, and wild, unbroken stags bound and tethered to the same." "I know that chariot fighter," the king said. "Even the little boy, my sister's son, who this very day went to the marches. Surely he will have reddened his hand, and should his fury not be timely met, all Emania's young men will perish by him." Very quickly, a method had to be contrived to abate his heat, and one was found. 150 women of the castle, and Scandlach, their leader at the head of them, reduced themselves critically to nature's garb, and without subterfuge of any kind, trooped out to meet him. The little warrior, embarrassed or perhaps overwhelmed by such a display of womanhood, averted his eyes, at which moment he was seized by the men and soused into a vat of cold water. The staves and hoops of the vessel flew asunder. A second vat boiled. The third became only very hot. Thus Cathulainn was subdued, and the city saved.
A beautiful boy indeed was that. 7 toes to each foot Cahoolan had, and to either hand as many fingers. His eyes were bright with 7 pupils apiece, each one of which glittered with 7 gem-like sparkles. On either cheek he had 4 moles, a blue, a crimson, a green, and a yellow. Between one ear and the other he had 50 clear yellow long tresses that were as the yellow wax of bees, or like unto a brooch of the white gold, as it glints to the sun unobscured. He wore a green mantle, silver clasped upon his breast, and a gold thread shirt.
But when he was taken by his paroxysm or distortion, he became a fearsome and multiform and wondrous and hitherto unknown being. All over him, from his crown to the ground, his flesh and every limb and joint and point and articulation of him quivered. His feet, shins, and knees shifted themselves and were behind him. The frontal sinews of his head were dragged to the back of his neck, where they showed in lumps bigger than the head of a man-child aged 1 month.
One eye became engulfed in his head so far that 'tis a question whether a wild heron could have got at it where it lay against his occiput to drag it out upon the surface of his cheek. The other eye, on the contrary, protruded suddenly, and of itself so rested upon the cheek. His mouth was twisted awry till it met his ears. Flakes of fire streamed from it. The sounding blows of the heart that pounded within him were as the howl of a band dog doing his office, or of a lion in the act of charging bears. Among the aerial clouds over his head were visible the virulent pouring showers and sparks of ruddy fire which the seething of his savage wrath caused to mount up above him. His hair became tangled about his head, over the which, though a prime apple tree had been shaken, yet may we surmise that never an apple of them would have reached the ground, but rather that all would have been held impaled each on an individual hair as it bristled on him for fury. His hero's paroxysm projected itself out of his forehead and showed longer as well as thicker than the whetstone of a first-rate man-at-arms, and finally, taller, thicker, more rigid, longer than the mast of a great ship was the perpendicular jet of dusky blood which out of his scalp's very central point shot upwards and then was scattered to the 4 cardinal points, whereby was formed a magic mist of gloom resembling the smoky pall that drapes a regal dwelling, what time a king at nightfall of a winter's day draws near to it.